Hello and welcome to another episode of Politics Theory Other. I've been away this last week, so instead of the regular show, something a little bit different today. The following is a talk by Gilbert Achcar, who was recently on the show to talk about his book, The New Cold War, that he recently gave at the invitation of King's College London. 13 years have passed since the Arab Spring. The great hopes aroused in 2011 have been overwhelmed by counter-revolution and civil war. Yet the region is anything but restabilised. Instead of the events of the Arab Spring heralding a brief period of democratic transition, akin to earlier developments in East Asia and Eastern Europe, they instead, Gilbert argues, inaugurated a long-term revolutionary process based in a deep-rooted socio-economic crisis that is far from played out. In his talk, Gilbert assesses the dynamics of the MENA region, the factors hindering regional change, and he cautions against overly optimistic readings, while nonetheless arguing that there are main reasons for hope. Gilbert Achcar is Professor of Development Studies and International Relations at SOAS, part of the University of London. His many books include The Clash of Barbarisms, The Making of the New World Disorder, The People Want, A Radical Exploration of the Arab Uprising, and The New Cold War, The United States, Russia and China, From Kosovo to Ukraine. The latter was the topic of our recent conversation, and you can find a link to that episode in the description of today's show.
So, thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation. Thanks to the center, but essentially to Professor Hill, who invited me and gave me this kind of opportunity to meet you and discuss this issue with you. My topic will be, as announced, a reflection on the events since 2011, since the Arab Spring, and the attempt at giving you some explanation of the state of the region, the Middle East and North Africa, the MENA region, M-E-N-A, which has been in a state of upheaval, actually, ever since that great uprising of 2011. We agreed on this event before the ongoing genocidal war in Gaza, and that's not the topic, but I will nevertheless address this issue at the end of my talk. So basically what we're discussing is therefore a reflection on the Arab Spring and its consequences. And for those among you and who remember that time, 2011, it was a time of very, very great hopes in the region we are discussing, Middle East and North Africa. You've had a major regional shockwave in 2011, when almost all countries of the region, with the exception of very artificial entities like the United Arab Emirates or Qatar, where 90% of the inhabitants are expats or migrants or whatever label. But with such, I mean, if you put aside such exceptions, the whole region, practically all countries of the region, have seen some form of social protest rising in 2011. And six countries of the region went into a major uprising. Six countries, which were Tunisia, where it started at the end of 2010, Egypt, Libya, Yemen, Syria, and Bahrain. So six countries had a major uprising. And when you had a very, very high level of hope, which was renewed again in some way when you had what some of the media called the second Arab Spring, 8 years later in 2019, when you had four countries where you had new uprisings, which were Sudan by the end of 2018, where it started, and then Algeria, and then Iraq, and then Lebanon. So all in all, you have 10 countries of the region which, over those few years, have been into major uprisings. And that's almost half in terms of population, more than half of the population of the region. Six heads of states have been brought down by this movement. Ben Ali in Tunisia, Mubarak in Egypt, Gaddafi in Libya, Saleh in Yemen, Bouteflika in Algeria, and Omar Bashir in Sudan. So that was quite a lot. Every time, or most of the time, not every time actually, but in most cases you've had, well, at least in the cases where you had the heads of state being overthrown, you had constitutional processes starting, and all this created a lot of hopes. Hopes in 2011, renewed hopes in 2019, not the same countries, but still hopes for the region. And these hopes were based on the idea that what was at stake was essentially democratization, that we were in what political science calls democratic transitions, and that is what was at stake at that moment. That is the idea that the issue was just a matter of political change. Now, if you look at the situation today, we are quite far from the hopes of these two waves of uprisings that I mentioned. The balance sheet is rather dreadful. You know, if you look at it, we spoke of six countries going through major uprisings. Now we have to speak of six failed states. I mean, I don't like this category, and there's a lot to say critically about it, but it sadly applies to the region. You have a civil war in Syria, civil war in Libya, civil war in Yemen, civil war in Sudan, the most recent one, and you have states where the definition of the state, the classical definition, the Weberian definition of the state as the monopoly of legitimate violence within a territory does not apply, and these states are Iraq and Lebanon. So you see the condition of the region. You've had in other countries authoritarian setbacks, and that was early on. I mean, you had counter-revolutionary intervention in Bahrain. You had this authoritarian setback in Egypt, in Algeria, in Tunisia most recently, and Sudan also through the civil war, but before the civil war, you had a new coup, a counter-revolutionary coup. And overall, look at the region today, it's the strongholds of reaction that seem to be dominant politically in the region, and those are led by the main major reactionary stronghold in the region, which is the Gulf Cooperation Council, and especially the Saudi Kingdom and the United Arab Emirates, playing the role of the with some rivalry. There are rivals and have been developing a rivalry like in Yemen, but they are both opposed to the revolutionary change in the region. That's what they certainly have in common. So major difference between the hopes and the outcome, the present outcome. That's what precisely I'm going to address, to try to explain. For this, we need to clarify the roots of the major uprising, the roots of the Arab Spring. So, as I said, the expectations about the movements, and the most optimistic expectations, were based on considering them as just democratic transitions, as just a matter of political change. And that was actually quite short-sighted, because the fact is that these movements were, above all, the expression of a deep structural social economic crisis. And that's what produced this condition of upheaval that started late 2010 and 2011. That's the analysis that I produced in the book, The People Want, which came out in 2013 in its first edition. to summarize it, I attributed the social explosion to the combination between a peculiar system of states characterized by the existence of a hardcore of patrimonial states. And what does it mean? That means states which are actually owned by the ruling group, by the ruling family. And these are monarchies, but also a few republics. A few republics turned also into patrimonial states where you have ruling families owning the state in the same way as you have in monarchies. I mean, that's not only in the region. If you think of North Korea, for instance, that's a republic, so-called republic, which is even more absolutist than a monarchy. So you've had that in the region where you have six monarchies and you have states like Syria, Libya, and even Iraq under Saddam Hussein, but that was ended in 2003 by the US-UK invasion of the country. So you have a hardcore of patrimonial states, and the rest of the states of the region are neo-patrimonial states, but with a high degree of nepotism and corruption. And three of the states of the region are actually military regimes, where the backbone of power is the military, the army, and these are Sudan, Algeria, and Egypt. Egypt being a model of this kind of state. So the combination of this particular system of states with neoliberal changes is what produced the outcome at the social economic level that has been decisive in creating the political explosion. The key point is that the neoliberal changes are based on the postulate of a leading role in the economy for the private sector. And the postulate is that if you liberalize the economy, if you retrench, if you withdraw the state and open the gates to the private sector, you will have economic miracle. You will have economic growth and you'll have countries taking off on the track of development. Well, that postulate, therefore, is based on this key central role for the private sector. But they make an abstraction and they completely ignore the different conditions between countries. And that's quite typical of the international financial institutions, I mean, the IMF and the World Bank, of having exactly the same set of recipes for all countries in the world, overlooking the huge differences that exist between countries and the huge differences in the economic and social conditions between those countries, including also the huge difference in the nature of the state and, I mean, whether the conditions for private sector activity are met or not. And that's the key point to understand the thing, because the issue is not neoliberalism per se, which has produced in some countries fast growth. Take Turkey as an example, with some social cost, of course, but there has been some economic achievements, whereas in the Middle East and North Africa and the Arabic-speaking countries, this has not happened. And that is because there were no conditions in that part of the world for a private sector activity at a level of investment and long-term investment that would be conducive to development. And that's what produced a quite slow GDP growth, especially per capita, compared to the demographic progression in the region. Slow growth and therefore inability to absorb new entrants to the labor market were not absorbed by the economies. And this produced massive youth unemployment, record rates of youth unemployment, the highest rates of youth unemployment in the world, of any region of the world. Middle East and North Africa has had the highest rates for a couple of decades before the explosion, even three decades, the highest rates of youth unemployment of any region of the world. And this is absolutely crucial as a factor in the explosion. The frustration of young people created by this set of conditions that I mentioned translated in the political upheaval. You may find other parts of the global south where you've had low growth for some period, but they are usually poorer parts of the global south than the MENA region, which means that a lot of the unemployment becomes disguised unemployment in the informal sector. You have that, of course, in the MENA region, but less because you have a larger proportion of lower middle class sectors who benefited from the democratization of higher education promoted by the nationalist populist regimes since the 60s. And therefore, you've had a large production of graduates. And a key part of this youth unemployment that I'm mentioning is also graduate unemployment. And that's also one key to understanding the upheaval and the role of social media users, which are not the poorest of the poor, because they have this ability to use the social media and the internet and the new technologies, and the role they played, which is well known, in those uprisings. Now, if you start from that and you understand that this is the root cause of the big explosion, and not just some political frustration because we don't have democracy and freedom, but because, I mean, this frustration could have started decades before, because you have had despotic regimes in the region for a very long time. So when you understand that what led to the explosion was not only, I mean, I'm not saying that repressive conditions or oppressive conditions are not part of the picture. They are, definitely. But they are not the only reason. The key reason is their combination with the social economic frustration, which leads to the explosion. Now, when you get to that kind of analysis, you draw a few consequences. First, that this is not a short-term, rapid democratic transition. And this is something I've been saying since 2011. And at that time, I was appearing as a very pessimistic guy when everyone was absolutely very optimistic and with a lot of hopes about what was going on. This is not East Asia, where you had a democratic transition, which came on top of a long period of intensive, rapid development, economic development. And the political transition was an adaptation, if you want, of the political conditions to the economic advancement. In this part of the world we are discussing this evening, this is not at all the case. In the contrary, as I just explained, you have a quasi-stagnation economically that will lead to the explosion. So if the deep roots are structural and are social economic, that means we are facing a long-term revolutionary process, not a short-term transition. A long-term revolutionary process which can spread over decades and decades until there is a solution that solves, I mean, a solution to the social economic crisis, unblocking it and putting the region on the track of development. Second conclusion you can draw from the analysis that I made, that I summarized, is that the obstacles to change are absolutely formidable in the region. And here you have another comparison we can make. If you take Eastern Europe also had a political explosion due to economic stagnation. That is closer to what you had in the region, except that in Eastern Europe you had bureaucracies, you didn't even have property classes. You had no, I mean, so the situation is absolutely opposite to the patrimonial hardcore of states that you have in the region. And whereas a bureaucratic state can collapse in the way we have seen in Eastern Europe, that cannot happen at all in patrimonial and neo-patrimonial states, where you have not only property classes sticking to their privileges much more than any bureaucracy, to their ownership, but even groups owning the state, regarding the state itself in the patrimonial state as their property, private property. So formidable obstacles with a system of states which is particularly resilient. And a region where you have an intimate connection in most cases between the regime, you know, the most famous slogan of those upheavals of 2011-2019 was "Al-Sha'b yurid al-Nizam," which means the people wants to overthrow the regime. But the question is that in many countries, the regime is inseparable from the state. The regime is the state is the regime. They are so much connected that the collapse of the regime means the collapse of the state, as you had most the most complete manner in Libya, when the Libyan regime of Gaddafi collapsed, and with it, the whole state collapsed, and it became a kind of stateless country from that angle. That also means that in the patrimonial states, where you have ruling families owning the state, there is no way to overthrow the regime or the monarchy or the dictatorship like Libya or Syria, whatever it is, peacefully. That can't happen. And betting on even the army, like in those neo-patrimonial states where the army is the backbone of the regime, such as Sudan, Algeria, and Egypt, look at that. You had exactly the same scenario in the three countries I mentioned. The army removed the president. That was in Egypt 2011. That was in Algeria and Sudan 2019. This can't happen in the patrimonial states because of the specific connection between the ruling families and the key and elite bodies of the armed forces, to which they are linked through the family, through the tribe, through whatever. You have a familiar tribal and regionalist control of those apparatuses, which means that when you have an uprising, the most likely outcome, if the uprising is lasting, is civil war. It's civil war because they will use every kind of violence against the uprising. The uprising will be led to arm itself, to respond to this violence, and then you get into civil war. And otherwise, in those cases where you have, which are not patrimonial, but neo-patrimonial means it's a kind of a category halfway between the patrimonial condition where you have the ruling family, ruling group owning the state, and let's say the legal bureaucratic form of state. So it's the difference is you have nepotism, you have corruption, you have all this, but you don't have, I mean, the state is not the ownership of a family. For instance, I mentioned the three countries where you have military regimes, even though Mubarak's sons played a role, but you couldn't say that the Mubaraks owned the state, neither even Bashir or even less Bouteflika. The real owners, or if you want, the real is the institution. And the degree of institutionalization is the characteristic of neo-patrimonial condition as contrasting with the patrimonial states. And there you can understand why in those neo-patrimonial conditions you can have the head of state removed, whereas you couldn't have this in Libya, and it can't happen in any of the monarchies because they are all, even when they have some kind of parliamentary representation, but they are all basically absolutist monarchies and therefore patrimonial states. So therefore, these are the conclusions that flow from the analysis of this structural crisis that is at the roots of the big uprising. I will add to this in the explanation of the condition that is now prevailing into which we are now, is a factor that complicates all this, is the strategic and economic value of the MENA region. In other words, what can be called the oil curse. the oil resources in the region have been a central cause for foreign interference in the region at a much higher level than other parts of the world. And that explains why the region is such a theater for regional and international cross-border interventions, which are actually developing. Now we are reaching a peak in the last few months. Just look at what's happening. You had the same night, Turkey bombing Syria and Iraq, Iran bombing Syria and Iraq, and then later bombing Pakistan, Pakistan bombing Iran, and the United States bombing Yemen. And of course, Israel is bombing Gaza and Lebanon and Syria every now and then. I mean, it's that kind of situation is to be found nowhere else in the world. There's no geopolitical part of the world where you have this this density and intensity of conflict and clashes. And you see how this impacted the uprisings through foreign interventions. That starts in 2011. The first one is the Gulf countries in Bahrain to repress the uprising in Bahrain. That was the first one. Then you had NATO in Libya trying to hijack the uprising. Then you had Iran, Russia, Turkey, Israel, and the United States in Syria. I mean, it's open ground for many countries. In Libya, you have a proxy clash between Turkey, Qatar on the one hand, and the UAE, Egypt and Russia on the other side. In Sudan, it is becoming also a proxy war between the UAE and Russia on one side and the Saudi Kingdom and Egypt backing the other side. So you have this dynamics in the region which complicates the whole thing a lot. And you have ongoing efforts by the United States to set up a regional military alliance of the Saudi Kingdom, the UAE, Bahrain, Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, and Israel versus Iran's regional expansion. So all these factors, and here, both sides, I mean, both sides play counter-revolutionary roles, the US and its allies, and Iran also, as has been very clearly the case in Iraq against the uprising in 2019, or even in Lebanon. A fourth important factor in complicating the condition in the region is the existence of a specific opposition force which has been there for a very long time, which is the Muslim Brotherhood. So an Islamic fundamentalist modern political movement that was founded a century ago now in Egypt and spread to the whole region and the world. It's an international organization. It has branches everywhere where you have Muslims, basically, or most of the countries, I mean, in the West and the Middle East and some parts of Asia. Central Asia. So today, the Muslim Brotherhood is backed by Qatar and Turkey, but until 1990, it was essentially backed by the Saudi Kingdom. It was funded and supported by the Saudi Kingdom and used by the Saudi Kingdom and the United States as an antidote against left-wing nationalism and the communist parties and the Soviet Union. So the main ideological antidote that Washington used in this part of the world in conjunction with the Saudi Kingdom is Islamic fundamentalism. And you see the difference with, for instance, the discourse of human rights and freedom and the rest used against Eastern Europe or the Soviet Union. You haven't had this at all in the Middle East and North Africa. The United States was quite happy relying on the Saudi Kingdom ideologically to wage the fight against the forces that I mentioned. And the Muslim Brotherhood took advantage of the failure and decline of Arab nationalism, of left-wing Arab nationalism, starting from the 70s. I mean, the first decisive blow was the June war, so Israel played a key role in defeating the radicalizing trend of Arab nationalism, which went quite quite far to the left in social economic measures. This was defeated, and the 70s were a period of transition. And later on, after 1990, you had a break between the Muslim Brotherhood, which had started filling the vacuum left by the nationalism. The Saudi Kingdom broke with them in 1990 because they did not support the U.S. war, the U.S. intervention in the region, and the 1991 U.S. war, first U.S. war, U.S.-led war on Iraq. A few years later, they became back by Qatar. They had a new sponsor from the Saudi Kingdom. They removed sponsorship to Qatar, but they developed into the main opposition movement in the region. So we moved from a period a few decades before, when the main opposition movements were nationalist and communist, to one where the main opposition became the Muslim Brotherhood. And they had this strong backing in not only funding, but also television backing, which is, as you know, very important in modern politics. In 2011, actually, they were seen by the Obama administration as the best option to defuse the tension of the Arab uprisings, to keep these changes, the uprising, within acceptable limits for Washington. So there was a moment of betting also on Qatar and Turkey's role in that regard, but on the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Obama administration favored even a compromise between the Muslim Brotherhood and the old regimes. And you had expressions of this compromise at a certain point in time in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Yemen, and in Morocco. However, these forces appeared as political alternatives, but they were not social economic alternatives in any way. They were actually even more radically neoliberal in some instances than the old regimes. And therefore, they were doomed to fail. And that was predictable. You'll see in the book, for instance, you have this prediction about the fall of the Morsi experience in Egypt before it happened. But the book, the first edition of the book, came out before the coup that brought down the Muslim Brotherhood experience in Egypt. Same goes for Tunisia, same goes for Morocco. The Muslim Brotherhood, wherever they came to government or just took part in government, as was the case, for instance, in Tunisia after 2014, they were part of a political setting that was different politically from the previous condition, but not socially, economically. The countries remained on the same path, and it got worse because all the political, legal conditions that explain the economic blockage that led to 2011 only worsened after 2011 due to the upheaval in the region. Instability, the further instability added to the unpredictability that results from the existence of very centralized nepotistic regimes, and this only worsened the economic condition. So this set of factors and of reasons is what explains the present condition in which we are, and how we moved from these great hopes in 2011 and 2019 to the rather depressing condition that is prevailing today. Now, if we also take a broader and more global perspective briefly here, we'll see an acceleration of the crisis of neoliberalism since the Great Recession of 2008, as it's called. And this acceleration of the crisis of neoliberalism led to two types of radicalization, completely opposite radicalization. It's not that there's nothing original about that. We've seen the same in previous periods of history, like between the two world wars of the past century. You have some progressive radicalization, translated in in occasions like the Arab Spring, like Greece, Spain, even United States, you had some rise of left-wing radicalization, but you also have had a global rise of the far right, very clearly progressing after that turning point in the global crisis. And this global rise of the far right was actually in some ways spearheaded by Israel. Netanyahu is in many ways an archetype of the new global far right. Netanyahu comes to power, second time, but this time for the long haul, in 2009, is a very characteristic figure of the new type of far right in the 21st century. And this was part of a right-wing drift, and drift to the far right in Israel, a drift to the far right that has been continuous actually for a few decades, ever since the Likud came to power in 1977, and the Likud itself drifted towards the far right. This will lead to increasing oppression in the occupied territories, will foster, therefore, a counter-radicalization in the form of Hamas and other movements. And the clash of these two trends is now before our eyes with the genocidal war that Israel is conducting in Gaza. Why am I mentioning that? Well, because this war that is going on in Gaza will have tremendous consequences in the region, and actually not only in the region. It will spill over to Europe, it will spill over to other parts of the world for sure. But this is creating a massive and very deep political frustration, huge anger, and legitimate anger, I should add, against what is going on. And if you think of 2011, you think of the social economic roots that I mentioned. But of course, you had also political factors intervening in the radicalization. And one of them was Iraq, the occupation of Iraq, that played a key role in that regard. And Palestine. Palestine, for instance, a country like Egypt, you see how the first phases of the political struggle of some of the movements which became prominent in 2011 was related to the Palestine issue. And therefore, you have now a massive political anger that is rising again, that will translate in some unfortunate ways, partly like the frustration created by the defeat of the first wave of the Arab Spring that fed into the rise of the Islamic State, ISIS, as it's known. If you take a country like Tunisia, you will see that you have had, because of the frustration post-2011, a proportion of young people going from Tunisia into ISIS, which is a very high proportion compared to the size of the country. So you will have that form, but you will have healthier kind of radicalization in the form of anger against the existing regimes. And therefore, this will combine necessarily with the ever-increasing social economic crisis in the region into continuing the long-term revolutionary process. So I get back to where I started with the long-term revolutionary process that starts in 2011. This will carry on. There is no way that this part of the world could get back to any form of despotic stability. Anyone betting or believing that you can get back to the form of dictatorial, authoritarian stability that existed before 2011 are dreaming. This can't happen because of the structural issues that I mentioned. And we can see the social economic process at work in even a country like Syria, despite everything that Syria has been on one of the cruelest tragedies in modern times Syria has been through. And yet, you've had a social explosion a few months ago in Syria, and it's not finished. But you have a massive social protest in parts of Syria which are under regime control, under the control of the Assad regime. And that tells you that the social economic issue is still there as a catalyst for a social struggle. And the same I can add here is Morocco, which has been and is still witnessing one of the most important, and you won't hear of that in the news. Huh? You can hear a lot of things, but not social struggles. This is very rarely reported in the kind of media that we know. But Morocco has been through and still going through a very important social struggle of the teachers, but this is a very massive sector, and it's been going on for a few months now. So that is just the indication that, however bleak the situation may look today, the ingredients for the social political explosion are still there. By saying that, I'm not trying to be optimistic or make you optimistic. And I would be lying to myself and to you if I tried, because there is no ground for optimism. For all the reasons I even explained before, the formidable task, the formidable challenge that any real change in the region represents. But there is ground for hope. I make this distinction. It's important to make the distinction between optimism, which is the belief that the best will happen, the best case scenario, and hope, which is the belief that there is the potential for a better, if you want, ending. Another world is possible, if you want, but it is a potential, not something that is to be taken for granted. But the problem is the alternative that the region is facing is, because of all the explanations, all the factors that I underlined, the alternative is between more and more of the kind of barbarism that we have seen developing in the region since 2011 in those civil wars, and now with the genocidal war going on in Gaza. The alternative is between more of that and between the radical social political change that this region is in a very, very high need of. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Politics Theory Other. If you've been enjoying the show, please consider becoming a supporter on Patreon. £5 patrons get access to PTO Extra, bonus episodes of the show, usually two per month, including listeners' questions episodes, where you can hear recent guests respond to comments and questions sent in by PTO supporters. Go to patreon.com/polltheoryother to sign up. The show's music and graphic design is produced by Planet B Productions. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week.